Well, as you are well aware, we have been working our way through the book of Isaiah, and we have completed the first 35 chapters. And it's been a pretty good haul already going through that. If you are familiar with Scripture to some degree and are familiar with the prophets, then you will probably be well aware that the book of Isaiah is one of those that is sort of at the pinnacle. It's like, this is the book. You want to get a handle on this. And it's really easy to get lost in the details in studying any particular topic, and the book of Isaiah is one of those that's easy to get lost in the details. So let's see if we can try to simplify a few things. Generally, the first 12 chapters are a pronouncement of judgment on Judah for failing to trust God. That's the basic essence of it, though it comes up from time to time because that's part of the larger issue. It's God trying to get his people's attention and to get them on track of realizing they need to be trusting him rather than other people, other nations. But there's another part of it, and that is also there's judgment on the nations for failing to respond to truth. Because there's a certain amount of general revelation that's out there, and the presence of God's people on the earth was to be a light to the Gentiles as well. And the nations were accountable. And part of what Judah needed to hear is that God is the God of the nations, all the nations of the earth, as well as their God, because the tendency was of the peoples in this time frame to focus on, well, we're a nation, we have our God, you're a nation, you have your God, and on and on. And so there's just these little territorial deities that are associated with various areas, but this is to say, no, God is the God of all the nations, and all are held accountable, including his own people. So if you can, to this point, sort of grasp the essence of that picture, that's a good start on things. But then we come to the next section, and that's chapters 36 to 39, and this is an important historical transition. Because we've come to through the first part, we have a transitional section, and then we're going to break into the final section, which is different in its focus, that as we will see. Enough different that some of the liberals have said, well, this is so different that it must be a different author. And so they have suggested there might be another author there. Well, there isn't any reason for that. It's just because it's a different focus, and that needs to be taken into account. But this transitional section also reinforces the emphasis on need for trust. So the first section of the book of Isaiah, all you have to know is the word trust, because that's what it's all about. Are you trusting in me, says God, or are you trusting in the nations? That's the main element here. And so there is some historical accounting given in these middle section of this transitional portion of Isaiah that reinforces the matter of the need for trust, and that's what's going to be brought out here. And so Hezekiah is referenced, and he is seen as a representative of the people as a whole, but he is sort of in the spotlight in this section. And so these are lessons from history that were to encourage God's people to trust him rather than trusting, as one has a tendency to do, in the arm of flesh. And then the last section, chapters 40 through 66, contain oracles relative to things that are coming in the future, with in the background the anticipation of the Babylonian captivity, which is part of this transitional section. So this transitional section forms a bridge of emphasis from a focus that has been on Assyria, because that was the main threat at the time that Isaiah was initially communicating here, to a concern about Babylon and what is to come in the future. And what's also interesting at least an observation worth noting, is that this transitional section is almost identical to 2 Kings chapters 18 through 20, and also, again, parallel to 2 Chronicles 29 through 32, with the exception of there's an additional poem that Isaiah includes that we'll be looking at when we get to chapter 38. And so that's simply to say this was a common text that the prophets had, and whether it was the historical book that had it first or whether it was Isaiah that had it first, some argue probably Isaiah had it first and it was included because it was prophets that put together the books of Kings and Chronicles anyway. So then this transitional section contains two parts. And I'm kind of belaboring this a little bit because we're dealing with a historical section here, this transition. So we need to think about, okay, what is involved with this? So the first two chapters of this section involve Hezekiah's response to the Assyrian threat. Assyria has taken the northern kingdom, has taken Syria, or also referred to as Aram, and some of the Philistines. And so they've already had an impact in the area. And guess who's next? Jerusalem, basically. It's where they have their sites. And so that's the concern that's here, because Sennacherib was basically knocking on Hezekiah's door at Jerusalem and saying, little pig, let me come in. If I can use some theological terminology from the past that you remember. So then the second part, verses 38 to 39, involves Hezekiah's response to his illness and to the Babylonian envoy that was sent to Jerusalem that is going to play rather significantly in things for the future. Again, chapters 36 to 37 is Judah's deliverance is provided. So that's hopeful. And then 38 to 39, Judah's captivity is announced. So they dodge one bullet, but not the next one, is basically the point that's being communicated here. And so this is a major hinge section. So if you can sort of focus on this as, you know, it's the hinge of the book. It's the center section. And the hinge really is between chapters 37 and 38, where the emphasis goes from Assyria to Babylonia. So that would be helpful to keep in mind to try to get that bigger picture. One commentator said, Hezekiah faced three crises in a short time that's focused in these four chapters. An international crisis, that was the invasion of the Assyrian army. A personal crisis, that was his sickness and near death, and then the prolonging of his life in a special way. And then a national crisis, which had to do with the visit of the Babylonians and the implications that that had. And he came out victorious in two of them and not so much in the third of them. So all of this is some background as we take a look at the text and want to be thinking about what are the implications for the present, that is the time of Isaiah giving this communication, and then for us as we're looking at it, how do we think about this, how might it relate to us in our day? So this text provides a significant historical context. That's important to see because it's obviously different. Instead of having the poetry, the poetic format, now we're in more of the prose history being given in this section for the most part. Oh, I just jumped ahead before I read the text. Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. That sounds ominous, but that's what has to be considered now and dealt with. This historical account is important background to Isaiah because much of what we have looked at in chapters 1 through 35, we're dealing with the anticipation of what was going to be taking place here. Some of it was in the form of warning. Some of it was in the form of giving insight with regard to this. There were other earlier historical accounts or references in the book of Isaiah. Much of the Isaiah is poetic in its format, but we said there were some historical elements in it as well. This is probably the fourth, at least, of the more obvious historical references. The first one is Isaiah chapter 6. That's the call of Isaiah, where it talks about his call in the year that King Uzziah died. So that's significant, and that year was 740 B.C., And then chapter 7 and 8, that was reference to Ahaz, where Isaiah comes to Ahaz and says, you need to be trusting the Lord, not trusting in Israel and Assyria, or looking for someone to keep you from the threat of Israel, the northern kingdom, and Assyria. And so they were looking then to Assyria. And chapter 20 has a reference with regard to Isaiah when he was called to be a physical illustration, where he's called to go naked and barefoot. And that was at a time when Assyria had taken Ashdod. So there was a historical reference there. So those are some things that had taken place prior to this. So now, Isaiah's ministry began in 740 B.C., in the year that King Uzziah died. Uzziah, also known as Azariah, reigned from 792 to 740 B.C., and then his son Jotham reigned from 750 to 732 B.C. Now notice, there's some overlap there, 10 years overlap. Well, it's referred to as a co-regency. It's not unusual, and it was pretty common actually in that time, where a father would be reigning and his son is going to be the next one, and so they would overlap for a time to make a more smooth transition. Sometimes it was a matter of the father having the common sense to plan ahead. Sometimes that didn't happen, and the king thought they were going to live forever, and they didn't make plans accordingly. And then Ahaz reigned from 735 to 715 B.C., and there was a three-year co-regency there. And then Hezekiah reigned 715 to 686 B.C., and Isaiah died in 681 during the reign of Manasseh. And that's referenced in chapter 37 and verse 38 of Isaiah. So the second historical account, the one that I referenced with regard to Ahaz, chapter 7 and 8, that was where Isaiah tried to persuade King Ahaz to trust God in the face of this threat that was coming to them from the north against Judah. But Ahaz refused to do so. Rather, he turned to Assyria. And now this Assyria that they thought was going to be their salvation now is the biggest threat they've got to face at that time. And so Hezekiah, now when he, as the son of Ahaz, is facing Assyria, he's going to take a different response than what Ahaz did. And so hopefully he has learned from his father's failure and has learned from Isaiah's preaching that he needs to be responsive and trusting in the Lord rather than trusting in some other nation. And so the result then from this section will be a deliverance that will take place, which that is in chapters 36 and 37, which is in stark contrast to what happened in chapters 7 and 8. Again, the theme of trust is foremost here. And we also need to remember, as we're thinking about this, these were real people in real time facing real situations, and they were not very easy ones, but it was real life. And this was a very threatening time. These were matters of great concern. We have issues that we face in our nation today, but we have nothing compared to what they had to deal with in the time frame that they were living. Then it was the 14th year of Hezekiah when Assyria comes knocking at at Hezekiah's door, and that would have been 701 B.C. So I know there's a lot of dates there, but if you can at least push it to recognize about 700 years before the time of Christ. And Isaiah's ministry began about 740 years before, so there's a 40-year period of ministry that Isaiah is involved with prior to this time. So just to give you a little bit of context, to keep that in mind. But also with that, 740 to 701, and remember you're having to go in reverse because it's before Christ. And just remember, when they were marking their calendars at that time, they didn't do it backwards. Okay, we are putting that on the equation here. They had their own calendar system. But remember, it was 722 that the northern kingdom, Israel, fell to Assyria. So put that time frame into the picture. So they've already seen the damage that Assyria has done to most all of the nations north of Judah. So it's pretty serious business. So in 701, the power of Assyria was also weakened a bit due to some internal strife. So it wasn't quite as powerful as what it was. And because of that, Hezekiah refused to pay tribute to Assyria. He thought, well, they're not quite as much of a threat as they were, so I guess I can, you know, not pay tribute for a bit here. So Assyria responded by pillaging many of the Judean towns and carrying many people back to Assyria. So they were then sort of working their way down, having pillaged many of the cities already, just like it says in the first verse there. And there's an Assyrian record where Sennacherib claimed to have taken 46 cities of Judah during this campaign. It's referenced also in 2 Chronicles 32:1, but it's on the prism of Sennacherib, also referred to as the Taylor Prism, which is now in the British Museum. So he went from the north, going particularly along the coast because it's easier to make time there. It's a little easier ground to work with rather than the mountainous area where Jerusalem sits. And so they were kind of picking off the easy picking stuff. And they took many of the towns there like Aphek, Timnah, Ekron, and Lachish. And then Lachish, which is about 30 miles south and some west, that is closer to the Mediterranean and south of Jerusalem, they used that as their staging area for attacking other towns. And so that's where this is coming from. One commentator referred to the way that Assyria was coming on to Jerusalem here as, quote, "The army of Sennacherib is swarming over Judah like a horde of Tolkienian orcs, and only Jerusalem remains." So any of you who have seen the Lord of the Rings or read the Tolkien books, you can appreciate the picture that's being communicated there. All of it to say this was serious business. This was major stuff that was going on. So then verses 2 to 3 say, "Then the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh," and we'll have to talk about what on earth that is, "with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem." So it gives you a little bit of background as far as where Lachish is and what was going on there. And then it says, "And he stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field." Now, I'm sure you've remembered everything you've ever read in the book of Isaiah, but maybe your mind is going back to a previous chapter where that exact same spot was referenced earlier. And then verse 3 says, "And Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him." So this gives us a picture of who we're dealing with here. So the confrontation, the national confrontation here, indicates a real and serious threat. So this is no small, little tiny incident. This is big stuff because it's been like a flood coming down on them. And so as we've noted, the delegation from Sennacherib launched from Lachish, which was roughly 30 miles south and a little closer to the Mediterranean in the Shephelah area. Of Israel. Now, the speaker of the group here is referenced as the Rabshakeh. And this seems to be a title, not his name, but a title that some have suggested may be equivalent to a field commander. That's how it's translated in the NIV. Or some might use terminology like chief of staff or governor. But he was a person who was in charge, and in the very least, he was the speaker here. Literally, the word that's used here is chief cupbearer, but that appears to have been an earlier name that had evolved in its function over time. And, for instance, Nehemiah in Nehemiah 1:11 was referred to as his position was the chief cupbearer, but he was essentially the king's personal advisor. So that gives you a little bit of a picture of who we're talking about here. There's also a bas-relief sculpture that's in the British Museum that shows Sennacherib besieging Lachish, this very place. So we have some visible, tangible evidence, and I think this is part of that that you see up front there as well. So in the other thing that I was referencing earlier, the place where the Assyrian commander stood near Jerusalem was the very same place that Isaiah had stood when he urged Ahaz to trust God 23 years earlier. And if you were to look at Isaiah 7:3, it says, "Then the Lord said to Isaiah, 'Go out now and meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field.'" And so, same spot. So it must have been the official meeting place for communicating things that needed to be passed along at that time. And then also we note here that the Assyrian delegation was met by the Judean delegation. So we've got some coming from two different countries being represented here. So Sennacherib's delegation consisted of three persons, and we see this when we look at the parallel passage in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 17, where it says, "Then the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshakeh from Lachish with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah. And they went up and came to Jerusalem, and when they had come up, they went and stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool, which was on the highway to the fuller's field." So again, multiple references to this same spot. Now, Isaiah is only referring to the speaker at the time, the Rabshakeh, and that was what was pertinent to his need at the moment. So then Hezekiah's delegation also consisted of three persons, and it's noted here, Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah, and they were all important officials in Hezekiah's government. And some have noted that there may be a reference here to the prophecy that Isaiah had given in chapter 22, verses 20 to 23, where he talks about the demise or the lowering of the position of Shebna and the rise of the position of Eliakim. And it may be that that had taken place by this time, or it may be that that was yet future, where Shebna is going to be depreciated in his position to a significantly greater degree. But all of that aside, the point here for the present is that this was a serious meeting of the minds. You've got three people coming from Assyria, three people coming from Hezekiah, and now they're going to have a little discussion. So this text provides a lesson on response to intimidation. And there was no small amount of it, as we'll see here. And this is the bulk of the issue that we'll want to consider today. This text then reads, beginning at verse 4 through verse 5 here, "Then the Rabshakeh said to them, 'Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? I say, you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. Now in whom do you trust that you rebel against me?'" And so this was intended to get their attention and to put them in a place of of being intimidated ultimately. So there was a direct and personal confrontation. They were face to face. They were stating what needed or what they wanted to say, that is, the Assyrian delegation. So here was a questioning of the basis for resistance, because Hezekiah had been resisting his required tribute to Assyria at this time, and so now Assyria is bearing down on them, and they're coming basically to Hezekiah to say, you can't win, give up, and it'll save us all a lot of fighting. So, that's it. We're done. Well, maybe not. There's a little more to it than that. So, the point of the Rabshakeh's first speech in verses 4 through 10 was to undermine Judah's confidence, to convince them to surrender without a fight. That was what he was aiming for. And he indicated that no deliverance would come to them. There was no hope. Nobody's going to come to Hezekiah's defense, not any of the people around that they might look for like an ally to help, and not their God. And so Judah should just surrender, because Egypt, who they had had some point of contact with, would not help. Verse 6, Yahweh would not help her. Verse 7, she would not have enough military manpower to win. Verses 8 and 9. And Assyria had authority from Yahweh to attack Jerusalem. That's the summary of what he's looking at here. And so this speech that the Rabshakeh is giving is basically challenging what Isaiah had been telling them previously, to say, trust in the Lord. And the Rabshakeh is saying, you can't trust anybody. Nobody's going to come to your defense. It's over. Give up. So that's pretty simple. The basic idea is you have no basis for resisting, and you have no hope of further resistance. And it was clear that this message was directed to Hezekiah, even though Hezekiah didn't give them the credence to show up himself. He sent some ambassadors essentially for him, just like the king of Assyria had done. So the Rabshakeh told the Judean officials to give Hezekiah a message from the great king. That's the terminology that he used, but he didn't refer to Hezekiah as king. He wasn't going to give him that credence. So the title that the Rabshakeh had used for the Assyrian king was one that they had typically used. It was part of their intimidation tactic, and it was commonly done. And he questioned, that is, the Rabshakeh questioned Hezekiah's confidence. It's like, what are you thinking that you're going to pull off to stand against us? I mean, look at everybody that we've taken down already. And so the picture here is, what do you do when you're the underdog? What do you do when you're in a nation where things have gotten to the point where there are more unbelievers than believers? And the unbelievers have at their disposal the major resources, a significant part of government, the media, the little tiny field of entertainment. I mean, that's massive when you think about everything that's involved with that. They, in every way, in their estimation, have the upper hand. And we are the little puny people from the past who really have nothing going for us. And the belief system that we have is based on nothing, in their estimation, but our imagination. And if we say it's the Word of God, they say that's just man's book. So where are we? I mean, aren't we in a similar position to what Hezekiah is in? Yeah, I'm trusting the Lord. Yeah, where is he? What are you really standing on? I mean, I was just reminded of this again this week. I heard its name just escaped me. I want to say Larry Moyer. That's somebody else. Albert Mohler. Yeah, that was the other guy. One's an evangelist. One's a sort of an apologist for our day. But he was talking about the situation with Karen Pence. And I'm sure you've heard some of that. The media has been like obsessed that the second lady of our nation would have the audacity to teach art at a Christian school. And the Christian school excludes people of the LGBTQ, XYZ, whatever. And how can she, being in that position, be so out of touch and on the wrong side of history? They are just amazed and besides themselves. But that pictures what we're dealing with today. And a very similar picture, the very same attitude and disposition that Assyria is having, that the Rabshakeh here is communicating to Hezekiah's ambassadors, his people that are there, his delegation. And so the pressure had to have been rather immense, and it's not going to diminish for them or for us, for that matter. Verses 6 and 7 say, "Look, you are trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar?'" So here he's showing that he's done a little bit of research. And he knows a little bit about what's going on. He knows something about Egypt and how Egypt has functioned. And he knows something of what Hezekiah has done in his nation. So essentially this was a questioning of capabilities and resources. The Assyrians knew that some of the Judean nobles had put their trust in Egypt and had sent ambassadors there to make a treaty that was referenced in Isaiah chapter 30, verses 1 through 17, when Isaiah was saying to them, "What are you thinking going to Egypt?" But they also knew, probably better than the officials of Judah, that Egypt was not a particularly reliable place to go to. It either didn't have the capability or it wasn't dependable enough to actually follow through, and so it would actually harm them more than help them. So that was a concern as well. But the Rabshakeh also knew of Hezekiah's religious reforms that he had done. That's referenced in 2 Kings 18 and 2 Chronicles 29 to 31, where Hezekiah had removed the altars that were in the high places and all of that. And here the Rabshakeh made an assumption that when Hezekiah removed these things, he was actually alienating God because they were God's altars. Well, actually, they were used for idol worship. And even though some of the people of Judah may have revered these things, Hezekiah was doing something to honor the Lord. And so here we have some of the intelligence that the Rabshakeh had that was misinterpreting the data. They had seen what was going on, but they misinterpreted what was there. So again, there's this questioning of the confidence that the king of Israel, king of Judah in this case, had, that he's putting forth. Then beginning at verse 8, "Now therefore, I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses, and if you are able on your part to put riders on them." And then continuing, verses 9 and 10. "How then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, 'Go up to this land and destroy it.'" Now here you've got to kind of wrestle with this. Was he right in this? What was he saying? So there was an official and intimidating challenge that's given here. And he's simply pointing out that Judah is inferior militarily and that the commander himself felt rather safe in offering 2,000 horses if Judah could put soldiers on them. And it was equivalent to saying, "Hey, look, we'll fight you, but we'll give you a lead." But he was pretty sure that they couldn't even come up with that. Again, it was just a matter of intimidating them. And that's what he was aiming to do, more mockery, more intimidation. Just saying, you know, you don't have what it takes. And there was some truth to that. The other element that's here, where it says, "Have I now come up without the Lord against this land?" He's essentially saying that he has authorization from the Lord for this. Well, is he right? Hadn't Isaiah said that God is sending Assyria to challenge and punish? Well, at times that was true, but it was also a basic ploy of the people of the day to say that we have the allegiance of your God on our side, or your God is really in our camp and helping us. And so on the one hand, you could say, well, there's a little bit of sense that, well, we know that the Lord was allowing Assyria to do this, but on the other hand, it wasn't anything to do with Assyria having the authority officially to do so. They were acting on their own. So then we have some pushback that's going to be coming up here. Verses 11 through 13. "Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, 'Please,'" and they probably are whispering now, "'please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. And do not speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall.' But the Rabshakeh said, 'Has my master sent me to your master and to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall who will eat and drink their own waste with you?'" I sense a little bit element of an arrogance here. And not only that, but he is telling, this is how we operate when we take people over. If you don't give in, so you better give in. "Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out with a loud voice in Hebrew and said, 'Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria.'" And so he's just doing exactly what he was intending to do, be threatening, intimidating, get their attention. So there was an official and intimidating challenge that caused pushback against the intimidation. So Hezekiah's officials interrupted the commander when they heard this rather unsettling claim of what was going to happen to them. And unfortunately, they had seen that kind of thing happen before. That's exactly what happened to the northern kingdom. They went through that very thing. When you think about the siege of Samaria, for instance, and the awful things that happened there, that scripture records. It was a tragic situation. But then there's a reference to the language here, speaking in Aramaic. Well, the time would come later when Aramaic would be a common language for the people of Judah, but it wasn't at this point, it was more a language of diplomacy, a language that was used between nations. And so they're saying, why don't you use this language instead of using Hebrew? Well, you know, they had been doing their homework. They had their Rabshakeh speaking Hebrew so that everyone could hear. But the people are the people of Judah, the delegation from Hezekiah, is trying to soften the blow here that's coming from these people because it's rather intimidating. And so this was a lot of pressure that was coming on them. And so they're trying to say, hey, come on, let's just talk about this. Let's just, we're friends here. We can work this out. Maybe they didn't use the word friends, but let's not be so vicious here. So they're trying to calm the thing down, but that wasn't going to happen. And so the Assyrian delegation made it clear that they wanted everybody to hear this because that is everybody, the people on the wall and all, they're going to be the ones who are going to be affected by whatever decision and response that Hezekiah has. So this was rather serious. Now, what we're seeing is the arrogance, the confidence that the opposition has to God's people. And we're seeing that today. It's intensifying. You can just see it in the attitudes, in the strength that is being gained on many fronts in our context today. And the hatred against those who believe in the Bible, who have the audacity to take the Bible as the Word of God, as truth, and actually believe it, and then to communicate it to other people out loud in public. I mean, what's wrong with you? I mean, if you want to just keep it to yourself, say in your house with it, fine, but don't get it out there for the rest of us to have to put up with. And so that's what we're dealing with. It's a similar kind of attitude and disposition. And really today, the biblical position on just about anything is directly and immediately opposed, and the opposite is taken. And we see that in all the tenets of the sexual revolution that are now seen as the new norms. And if you don't get with the new norms, then you need to get out of the way. And that's kind of what we're dealing with. So the disposition is so similar. Then looking at verses 14 and 15, thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Then continuing, do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present and come out to me, every one of you, will eat from his own vine, and every one of you from his own fig tree, and every one of you will drink the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and of vineyards. I mean, you know, such a deal. Just come along with us. You know, get with it. That's the element that's being communicated here. So there was an offensive and careless taunt. And we need to think about this. This included a recurring mockery regarding trusting the Lord. That was very evident there. You don't trust in Hezekiah because he's going to try to get you to trust in the Lord. And you can't trust in the Lord because he wasn't able to stand up when Assyria came up against Samaria. So why would he be able to stand up against us now that we're coming to you? He says, you know, you don't have anything to stand on here. And so, and of course, the Rabshakeh had raised his voice so that the people on the wall could hear, because he said, well, they're going to be directly affected by it. So he didn't have any hesitation to share that. So anyway, this continues to put pressure on the people and is undermining everything that both Isaiah and Hezekiah stood for. And that's the same boat that we're in. the same disposition. And the things that the Rabshakeh is saying to the people here, trying to make it sound like this is going to be a good thing. We're going to take you to a land just like your land. It's going to be great. You're going to have your own fig tree, your own cistern. It's going to be just wonderful. Oh, by the way, we're going to pull you there by hooks in your nose and so on, which is the mode that they tended to go by. And so it's a call to acquiesce, call to surrender before we come down on you and really wreak havoc on you. And we're experiencing the same kind of pressure today from the mindset of society as a whole. And they're telling us, get on the right side of history. You see, things are changing. Things are moving in a direction. We are enlightened. We are liberated from that narrow thinking of the past. Get beyond that. You know, they're saying, there is no God. God's not in control. You can't trust in him, so get with it. Go with us. And here, Isaiah is essentially communicating this for the people of Judah, reminding them of this, because they're particularly those people that are hearing it, but also for us as we're looking back at it to say, you think, that is Assyria and their people, think that you're in control, that you're driving this because the Lord has given you freedom to move that direction. What you don't realize is that the only reason you are able to make any progress at all is because there's an element of judgment on the nation that you're seeking to conquer. Otherwise, you wouldn't get any. And it's the same today. Is our nation under judgment? Oh, no. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's serious business that we're going through. You may not be able to find text in Scripture that says this relates to the USA, but if you can't see a parallel to what's going on by looking at this text, then you must have your eyes closed, because this is pretty obvious, the implications here. Then verse 18 says, beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad and the gods of Sepharvaim? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? No arrogance there. No confidence in the flesh there. Isn't that the attitude? This was the defiant and fatal mistake to look at it from sort of our perspective. You may have been able to get by with saying some of the things that you're saying, but now you have poked God in the eye. Look out. And that's essentially what's going to be taking place. So how many people today think that they are in control, that they are driving the cultural revolution, the sexual revolution, everything that we see of the Christian tradition dissolving before our eyes, except for the remnant of the faithful, which, of course, was present here as well. It's the Lord who has been allowing it in the case of Judah and in the case of our own experience today. And we're familiar with Romans chapter 1, and I'm not going to go into all of it there because there's a lot that we could make application to, but just looking at verses 24 and 25, therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their heart to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. There comes a point where God gives up on a society. Is that where we are? Is that what we're seeing? There seems to be some certain obvious parallels that we can see that we need to recognize. And so that's what we want to note today. And it's interesting that the Rabshakeh is, in essence, communicating something of the same thing that Isaiah was communicating. And that is, you can't trust in the people like Egypt or anybody else. Now, the Rabshakeh went so far as to say, you can't trust Yahweh either. But Isaiah said, you can. So that was a difference. But when we think about the increased opposition, the increased pressure that we are observing, just like what they were experiencing, the pressure was incredible. It was head on that they were experiencing. And the inclination is to say, well, maybe they're right. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe we better get on the right side of history. And this is saying, no, absolutely not. Wait till we get to the next chapter. And with that, let me just give you this, because I'm not going to deal with this now. I'm going to deal with it in the sort of the introduction to the next section, looking at chapter 37, because this really is the lead into it. But the text, the last couple of verses, includes a subdued response. And we need to think about what is our response to be. Well, there's an element where we need to have a subdued response. If you just go back in their face, it's probably not going to get you anywhere. But if you're trusting in the Lord and following His prescriptions and looking to Him, then we'll have the resources that we need. And that's where we need to look as well.